tirelessly working to improve the lot of mankind, or brilliant intellectuals, fearlessly searching for new ways to understand space, they should on no account miss a trip to Cannes this spring for a glimpse of the messy reality. For 4 days each May, the Botoxed masses, who usually monopolise the French Riviera town, are elbowed aside by the big cheeses of the world of architecture and development. Each year they flock here for a 4 day trade fair that brings every property developer with an ounce of fight left in them, every mayor with an election to win, and every realtor with an overhang of office supply to shift before their clients go bankrupt. It's in the booths and stands in the fair that gargantuan architectural projects get their first public outing. It's here too that Ken Livingstone, London's mayor, claims to a sceptical audience that London's Crossrail project would be going ahead. And it's here, in the overpriced beachfront restaurants and the late-night drinks parties at the Carlton, that the deals are done that will change the face of a score of cities around the world. Some architects are shipped in by their clients to perform like dancing bears for the investors and the potential tenants. Others come of their own accord to hang around with a fistful of business cards in the hope of making eye contact with the realtors in T-shirts, smoking Cuban cigars, and doing their best to look like the movie moguls who usually invest the place. Legend has it that the smartest hotels in Cannes get through more cases of champagne in one weekend of city building than in the entire film festival fortnight. Outside the gimcrack Palais de Congrès, you will find troops of Pritzker Prize-winning architects surrounded by hostesses in gold lamé swimsuits. Cossacks promote the Uzbekistan Urban Redevelopment Corporation, and rollerbladers attempt to suggest that Paris's La Défense office district is a happening youth culture kind of place, rather than the high-rise desert that we know it to be. Away from their natural habitat, mercilessly stripped of the props that they use to protect their image of omnipotence, architects are revealed for what they really are. Not Boy Scouts, but babbling fantasists peddling their pet projects, which I, for one, find a more reassuring vision than zealots on a mission. Inside those exhibition halls, every new idea, every bold attempt to reshape a city is somehow reduced to an apparently interchangeable kit of parts. You move from Bilbao's blurred virtual reality tour of its new concert hall, step on a plan of Rome spread over the floor, and immediately run across Beirut's plans to turn what was once the Paris of the Middle East into its Orange County. Ken Livingstone's vision of London competes with Frankfurt's bid to shore up its crumbling claims to be Europe's next financial centre. Both cities have giant models, and both strategies are characterised by interchangeable plans for daring office towers in the form of cocktail shakers. And how the architects love it. For a moment, they get to play at really being the tough-talking, hard-bitten masters of the universe who have seen it all before. And then it's time to go back to being herbivores in those funny round glasses that they wear to tell the world what they do for a living. After 4 decades in the wilderness, when, as a result perhaps of the well-publicised mistakes of the 1960s, architecture was all but excluded from every meaningful conversation about the nature of the city, it is now possible once again to talk about designing the city as a physical entity. It has not been an easy transition. Architecture, with its connotations of subjectivity and emotional resonances, has not been a comfortable fit with the supposedly more objective and scientific concerns of policymakers and statistically based analysis. But it does have things to offer to even the most sceptical. Not least is its role in the manufacture of identity in the urban context. Architecture has the unique ability to make something a visible possibility long before it has actually happened. Architecture creates a sense of what a city is like. It is what we use to identify a city, an apparently extremely primitive totem pole. And yet this ancient throwback has never been more in demand than it is now. When the Prime Minister of Malaysia, Mohamed Mahathir, wanted to tell the world that his country existed, he followed in the footsteps of Ataturk and Mitterrand, the Shah of Iran and Stalin, Thomas Krenz and Nelson Rockefeller, and turned to architecture and building. The world which could not put Malaysia on a map can now recognise Kuala Lumpur thanks to Caesar Pelle's twin towers. When Olympia in York needed to demonstrate to sceptical tenants that their new office development in London's Canary Wharf, that an ex-banana warehouse was in fact a viable business district, they also commissioned Cesapelli to build the tallest office tower in Britain. Why, wailed the Prince of Wales, does it have to be so tall? The answer the Reichmans were too polite to give him was that it needed to be so tall so that it could make the middle of nowhere look like somewhere. This is a process that is also affecting the nature of architectural practice, which was once bitterly divided between business and art. London now has major commercial developments that have involved Jean Nouvel, Rem Koolhaas, Foreign Office architects and others. Architects of this type would never previously have been considered for so-called commercial work, but were confined to the ghetto of the museum. Partly those names are there as trophies, but it is also because they have ideas to offer, which are the most precious commodity in the development process, and the one which is in the shortest supply. This openness to ideas in the physical form of development is not one that New York has as yet developed. Canary Wharf may be a clear descendant of Manhattan's World Financial Center, right down to the Barrel Vault Atrium and the Royal Palms. But since then, New York has stagnated architecturally in a way that London has not. One of the popular themes in contemporary business books is to compare and contrast the corporation to the nation state, and to explore what it is that makes a commercial entity persist and survive, even when nation states fail. Very rarely is architecture regarded as an essential part of the identity of a successful corporation. Quite the opposite. A monumental headquarters building has more often been taken as a signal of imminent corporate collapse, of the kind demonstrated by AT&T with its Philip Johnson-designed building on Madison Avenue that is now home to Sony, than it is of robust commercial good health. Perhaps this history is one of the many reasons for the friction between those who look at the city from the point of view of design and those who are more interested in what they regard as more objective forms of analysis. But to survive as cohesive entities, cities depend above all else on their sense of identity. Identity is the product of their architecture, their history, and their geography, and their climate. Of these, architecture is the only factor that we can readily manipulate. In the end, identity is stronger than any other reality, and that is more true now than ever. But the larger the city becomes, and the more its nature is diluted by the impact of new techniques of city building, the more difficult it becomes to achieve that sense of cohesion. Coming to terms with the evolving nature of the contemporary city means facing up to the reality of the extraordinary size jump of the later years of the 20th century. Scores of cities now have populations far larger than that of entire European nations. A city with an effective population of 18 million people is an entity with no historic precedent. We have no experience of how such an entity can operate. On the contrary, we have far more examples of cities losing their sense of cohesion and identity, and others which stubbornly maintain their own identity even as they merge physically with others. The Randstad, for example, is so much less than the sum of its parts, mainly because even as Amsterdamers take the train to their jobs in Rotterdam and never lose sight of continuous urban development on the entire journey, they never for a moment forget their sense of themselves as being citizens of Amsterdam. And the same is true for the countless thousands of Rotterdamers making the journey in the opposite direction. They all live in what is effectively a single city 50 miles long, but bound by the tribalism of football parties, primary schools, the evening paper that they read, the bar they drink in, Rotterdamers know exactly who they are, just as Amsterdam is equally united in its unshakable conviction that it is anything but Rotterdam. Until the 20th century, we saw successful cities expanding and growing by absorption and co-option. London was once two cities, London and Westminster. Westminster still exists. It even has its own mayor, its own city hall, and its own policy on congestion charging and planning controls. But there is no question that Westminster is an essential part of London's identity, just as Brooklyn and Queens are an essential part of that of New York. But in the past two decades, balkanization of the city has become a more common phenomenon. Berlin was cut in two. Beirut became three or more zones. Belfast and Sarajevo were cut into shreds, each fragment with their own social geography. Shanghai was born as a city with three simultaneous administrations. In 1929, you needed three different driving licenses issued by three different countries to cross it. The example of Los Angeles, with its regular wars of secession, waged by wealthy communities seeking to avoid the tax burden supporting poor city centre areas suggests that balkanisation is a threat any city can face. And the city is facing other kinds of threat to its identity that may prove even more deadly. Richard Sennett talked eloquently about the danger that comes from oversimplification. We are approaching new urban development in ways that are too simple ever to result in real cities. Developers work in simplified chunks of building, simple enough so they can pitch the same package to bankers in London and New York and Tokyo. To raise global finance for a city project, investments need to be simple enough to be understood by people who have never been there. They need to be in a part of town that they can understand from their own experience. They need to have the kind of tenants they can understand with the kind of building and the mix of uses they can understand. Canary Wharf or the World Financial Centre are perfect examples of such oversimplified slices of city. They can be perfectly civilised with solid granite and public fountains and a convincing mix of uses, but they bear the same relationship to an authentic slice of city, which is necessarily complex, not simple, that Starbucks does to a family-owned Italian cafe. Oversimplifying a city means that you don't fix an alien shopping centre, you simply abandon it and you build a newer, bigger, better mall. The result is that the grain of the city is coarsened. It makes the city simpler to read. In terms of investment, it works at first. The funding is in place, the returns are there, but it makes the cities that work that little bit less well. They lose their diversity. They lose a bit of their extraordinary ability to renew and reinvent and regenerate themselves, like dying coral atolls in the Indian Ocean. Cities are the urbanistic equivalent of an artificial intelligence machine. You start with the most basic circuits that simply distinguish between on and off, or in this case, between building and the absence of building. As you add more and more components, you can eventually build a computerized chess player that will beat anyone but a grandmaster. So the accretion of urban ingredients, the house, the factory, the warehouse, the airport, the hotel, the theatre, eventually creates something that transcends the poverty of the ingredients. Building, non-building, may yet become Piazza, Square, Forum. The simplification of the city has the opposite effect. It shuts down more and more circuits bit by bit, rather like Stanley Kubrick's astronaut, forcing open the pod door, pulling the plug on Hal, and turning the sentient, self-aware computer back into a frightened pocket calculator. This search for simplification can also be seen as responsible for the mania for the architectural icon, the sugar rush of instant urbanism that comes from an artificially created monument that has been the chief demand on the skills of a select group of architects in the last decade, each being called upon to deliver a Bilbao, a self-defeating process that leads to architectural hyperinflation. London or New York are no longer a territory defined by political boundaries or transport authorities. London, as we've seen, spreads all the way from Bournemouth to Ipswich, New York from Connecticut to New Jersey. This is the kind of territory that needs some serious thinking about what it is that can stop cities from turning into balkanized sprawls, dissolving to nothingness on their edges. And it is not just about government boundaries. New York had Robert Moses and Wallace Harrison and Nelson and David Rockefeller and William Zeckendorf, who shaped its identity for better or worse in their own ways. London has had Frank Pick and now Norman Foster. What architecture can really do for a city is to try to inject complexity back into the increasingly oversimplified mix. It can reinforce its sense of itself, and in the end, nothing is more important than that.